I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome to another Chinchilla Squeaks with me, Chris Chinchilla. Today is the turn of an interview I did late last year at some point with Anna Scolicari, talking about her book, Learning Git, out now on O'Reilly. It was one of those interviews where I've been thinking about maybe bringing back video aspect of some of these podcasts, I don't know what to call them, but because with her, it was one of those interviews where her enthusiasm comes across in the audio, but if you could see her enthusiasm, you would get it a lot more. So it's a shame that that's lost a little bit here. Anyway, enjoy. And after the interview, I will come back to give you some updates and also give you some links to find out more about her book. But first, just some words from sponsors. Today, I am joined by Anna Scolicari. You have just finished a book, and we were going to talk about that book, but I think the book relates to a lot of your background. So maybe just give us a little brief potted history about yourself, and then we'll get to the book itself.
Yeah, I'm going to probably just share a little bit about my tech journey, because it's been a bit of a varied journey, and it's all led to this book. So basically, I started off in the tech space around 2017, working as a UX designer, actually, in London. And obviously, I was helping design apps and websites, and doing that kind of work made me really curious about how the developers that we would give our designs to would actually build those apps and websites. So when I moved to Barcelona, which is where I'm joining you now from, I went to a coding bootcamp and I learned the basics of web development in like an intensive 3 to 4 month program. And then I got a job as a front-end developer. And when I was working as a front-end developer, that's where I really had to use Git. So the book I've published, it's teaching Git, which is a version control system. And basically, and just for anyone that doesn't know, it's a version control system. It helps you to keep track of all the versions of your files or your code. It doesn't have to be code of your files. And it helps you collaborate with other people on projects. So basically, it's a very important tool for software developers, any kind of person writing code. And I was terrified of Git because it's a difficult technology to learn. And I decided to learn it really well while I was working as a front-end developer. And what I realized was that a lot of the resources out there that taught Git were really complicated and not designed for people like myself that had come from a non-technical background and learned to code. And yeah, I realized I could teach the technology in a much simpler way by using colors, visuals, and storytelling. So I actually made an online course at the time and uploaded that. And once that was live and I started getting reviews from people, I saw that it really resonated with people. Mm-hmm. People really liked it. It helped them understand things in a much simpler way. And at the time, I transitioned my career into more technical writing, which is what I do now. So I found myself in the intersection between tech and communication. And then finally, I decided once I'd seen that the course was doing really well and people liked the way that I taught, I decided to write the book. Mm-hmm. And the book basically teaches the basics of Git by using, again, colors, storytelling, and visuals. And it's a hands-on learning experience, actually. Yeah, that's the journey.
Okay. Let's actually come back very quickly to maybe the section of the audience listening or seeing your book title that might think Git is a known entity, a solved problem. It's so ubiquitous. Why do we need to still teach people about it? What would your argument against that be?
Oh, that's a good question. For anyone that already knows how to use it and they really understand it, you don't need my book.
No, for sure. Yeah.
There are tons of people that either need to learn Git and they're new to it. For example, technical writing teams that are going to start adopting a docs as code approach, or just junior developers, or just anyone that their team tells them, you need to learn Git, you need to start contributing to our repository, or you need to edit things in GitHub or GitLab or Bitbucket. So there's people that are coming into the Git space, into the space, into the tech space, or just need to learn Git for their work. And then there's also a lot of people that use Git in their day-to-day, and they've been using it for years, even could be even 5, 10 years, but they don't actually understand the fundamentals really well. They don't have a really good mental model of how it works. And therefore, they actually very often, and just like myself in the past, would get nervous during doing certain things using Git, or when they try to learn a more advanced feature, their mental model breaks down because they're like, oh, I don't actually understand what this feature is going to do because I don't have a good idea of the fundamentals. So there's a lot of people that still need help in creating a mental model of how Git works, whether they're complete Git beginners or new to Git, or whether they've been using it for a long time.
Yeah. I actually have a use case from this week, because also as a long-term tech writer, I think we straddle those groups of people who are familiar with it and who aren't familiar with it. And even people in our own role can fit into both of those buckets or somewhere between the two. So I had an example of that this week where I wanted to get someone to look at some content, and they said, oh, I don't understand GitHub, so I put it in a Google Doc. And of course, for people who know Git, you're always like, oh, another tool. This is actually, when you start to learn Git, you realize it's sometimes even better for reviewing than something like than a Google Doc. But what would be your initial just recommendations, comments, assurances to someone coming from a more traditional, let's call it version control review system like Google Docs or Word, to what Git is and why it's different, if you think it is?
Oh, that's a really good question. The nice thing with Git is you can see every single version of your project, exactly what changed, when it changed, who changed it. And also, I think Git, when you think about scaling something, like having a lot more people contributing and giving feedback on a project, I think Git manages that better than Google Docs. What else? At the end of the day, if you're working in the tech space and you're working with developers, or basically you can't use Google Docs. You can't ask a developer to copy code or copy like documentation from. It makes collaborating. It makes collaborating with developers a lot harder if you ask them to copy code and documentation that's intermingled together in a file into a Google Doc, and then to edit it there, and then to put it back into the repository. That could lead to a lot of issues in the process. So yeah, I think that's it.
Okay, and why do you think a lot of people will struggle to begin with? Is there an element that Git is inherently complex, or is it that because it's perceived, and this is a wider problem in technology, it's perceived as one of these technical things, I couldn't possibly understand it? Or this common rebuttal you hear with so many technical things, oh, I'm afraid of breaking something, which in theory with Git actually, that's okay, because you can undo it again. But why do you think people are put off even taking those first few steps into something that, like Git?
First of all, I'd say it's very legitimate that people are scared of Git, because Git, it could be a lot simpler, but it's not. So what I want to say is that the person that invented Git is Linus Torvalds.
Yep.
He's also the inventor of Linux. And he is extremely good at technical things. But I think when he was creating Git, he really prioritized the features he wanted to include in Git. Mm. And he was not prioritizing the user experience.
No.
So he did not think about how the user was going to learn this tool, what language he should use in this tool, what a workflow would look like. These are all assumptions, but I'm assuming he mainly thought, I want this and this and this feature, and I'm going to build it. I don't think he did any user testing. I don't think he did any user feedback.
The interesting thing is that actually, and this is still common in Linux, or Linux core anyway, most people's experience these days with Git is with things like GitHub or GitLab, but that's not actually how it was created. It was created as a way of sending patches backwards and forwards by email, which tells you it tells you a lot that these tools we have that have added user friendliness on top are actually additions. That's not Git. That's something else. If you were to use pure Git, it would be even more complicated.
Chris, you are teaching me new things. I didn't actually know this.
Yeah.
So maybe I should add another chapter to the book of Git history.
I think it's changing because Linux core especially is suffering from the fact that it struggles to get new contributors because no one's used to that workflow anymore. And it's a terrible workflow, to be fair. So having everything buried in email chains. But when you look at when it was created, that made sense, of course.
I'd say one of the things was the way that it was created, and then two more things. First of all, it's originally you use it in the command line, and the command line is a scary place if you haven't been there and you don't know how it works and you just aren't familiar with it. So the command line is a bit scary, and sometimes you type in commands and a lot of things happen in the background. You don't see things happening. So that's why, for example, in my teaching approach, and I can get into this later, I make everything very tangible and very visual. And I give you like a action reaction. Like I show you that you do something and then something happens. Because sometimes you type in a command and there's nothing there. You'd have no idea what happened. And then one more thing, which is the language, branches, commit. Working directory. Sometimes some of these terms for someone that hasn't been working in the technical space, or even for people that have, they just don't make sense out of the box. You really need to start learning and understanding what these terms mean. So those would be my main assumptions as to why people hesitate with learning Git.
And just before, I'd like to come to your process or your explanation process in a minute, but just maybe you've already answered this a little bit, but what would be the thing you said to people to keep going through these challenges? Why is it, ignoring the fact that they just may have to for a job, what would be a justification to keep going? What's the positive outcome for them that they're going to have? Or is it just... because you've got
That's a really good question. To be honest, I don't usually have to convince people to learn Git. I just provide, once someone's decided they want to learn it, I'll provide them with the learning resources, but I'm not the one evangelizing, you must learn Git. I've been asked this question in the past, and all I've said is, look, if you need to use it for your work, you're going to come and find my book or someone else's learning resource, and you're going to learn it because you're not going to be able to collaborate with your colleagues otherwise.
Yep. Okay. So let's get to your process. How deep do you feel you have to go into the explanation? So you mentioned action, reaction, that kind of approach.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of weird edge cases with Git. Sometimes people who even think they are experienced with it, you can get these days where just nothing seems to be going according to plan and you don't really understand why, and you end up in a horrible mess without really understanding how you got there and how you got out of it. So how deep beneath the surface, how much do you abstract to make it understandable that maybe concerns you that you may have left out some details that people may stumble into at a later date?
Yeah. I do definitely abstract. I'm not going into the deep, deep, deep internals. I think I have just... through my teaching process, found the fundamental concepts that you need to understand in order to build the mental model. As I've already used this term a bajillion times today, but mental model, that's what I want to teach someone. And sometimes I show them things that they haven't learned with others. So for example, I mentioned before that I like to make things very tangible. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think a lot of educators don't show, or you just never really learn about, is you never actually see the .git directory, which mm-hmm. basically represents your local repository. So a lot of people don't know that in your file system, you have visible files and you have mm-hmm. hidden files. So in my teaching approach, I always, one of the first things I teach is, okay, let's learn how to see hidden files in our file system.
In all honesty, I think for anyone dealing with anything technical, depending what operating system you're on, you should have that enabled. I'm so used to seeing them now, I always forget. Oh, yeah. They're not there by default.
It's pretty crazy that you could be working with Git for years and not know that you can enable to see hidden files and you can actually see the .git directory. Yeah. Because basically, I find it really important to do that because then you can make it tangible. You can say, this is your local repository. Because otherwise, people are like, what's the local repository? I don't see anything. Mm-hmm. And then in my teaching approach, one of the other main things that I do at the very beginning is I build a visual thing that I call the Git diagram, which mm-hmm. shows you the different areas of Git. And I create a visual representation for each area. So I mm-hmm. show you the working directory, the local repository, the staging area, and the commit history. Okay. And what I do is I actually go into that .git directory and I show you which file represents the staging area, which directory represents the commit history. So this is something that people normally have never done while they're learning Git. First of all, I make things very tangible, and that helps people. And then also I make them very visual by providing these diagrams. To be honest, I've gone on a bit of a monologue now, and I forgot the original question.
Oh, yeah. How much do you feel like you have to go, let's say, into the weeds with...
Some people sometimes think that, wow, you're showing them the index file, you're showing them the objects directory or the .git directory. That's so, why do they need to know that?
Yeah.
That I think is really important in order to build that mental model. But there are a lot of things that I don't go into, like the internals of Git, things, blobs, objects, and all that kind of stuff. I don't go into all of that.
Okay.
I don't think you need to, you want to have empathy for your learner, and mm-hmm. overwhelming them with too much information that is not relevant for their learning journey at that moment in time is not a generous way of teaching, mm-hmm. I think. I do abstract them some things, but I've made a very intentional decision on what I do teach.
And to be fair, there are occasions where Git tools will tell you to delete certain files because it's the easiest way to get unstuck sometimes. Showing people that they exist is not a bad thing. I've ended up with some weird repositories sometimes where things have duplicated and stuff like that. And you would not have known it without looking in the file system and deleting them. Fix everything.
Yes. And I should probably not say this, but at the end of the day, usually there's, if you really get into a messy situation, often, as long as you've been committing and pushing often and doing various things, you can usually just start over. Just scrap it all, clone again, or get the branch again. And
How agnostic with what you show are you? Like Git is an underlying technology, but then a lot of people are used to almost synonymously thinking that Git and GitHub are the same thing. I always feel a bit sorry for GitLab, but there's also Bitbucket. There's also visual tools like Tower and Fork and Kraken and many, many others that all bring a slightly different nuance to the whole experience. So how pure are you in your explanation?
I'll be honest. I am not at all opinionated on anything. Mm-hmm. So my book... In it, I actually state this multiple times. You can use, to do the exercises in the book, you can use whichever hosting service you mm-hmm. want. You can use whichever text editor you want. And also, it's really important to state that my book teaches you a mental model of Git and how the tool works. Mm-hmm. But it does not, my book does not teach you how to use the tool. Mm-hmm. So I do not decide on what your branching strategies should mm-hmm. be, what your Git workflow should be. That is not my, at least not in this book, that is not my place to teach, because I believe Git is a tool and the way that you want to use that tool is completely up to you. And to be honest, it's probably up to your team. Every company, every project, every everything that you're going to work on is going to have a different workflow. So it's not up to me to tell you this is the right way to do it or that's the right way to do it. I don't even tell you what you should be naming your branches. Yeah. I don't tell you what you should be including in your commit messages because those depend on the project you're working on.
So I just teach you
how it works and then you go and use the tool in whatever way you need to.
And yet in every company or team I've ever worked on, everybody tells me their Git process is the only way. And the fact you've ever known a different way is crazy. So certain people are very opinionated and yet every company I've ever worked for has done things differently. So there we go. Git is like that. Yes. Everyone has an opinion. But just coming back to that very slightly, because there is always the complexity with something like a pull request or a merge request. A pull request especially has become so synonymous with Git, but it's actually a pure GitHub creation. So do you acknowledge that, at least that people are likely to hear that terminology and here's what it kind of means under the hood?
Yeah. So first of all, I just want to touch on what you said before, which is that sometimes people think that Git and GitHub are the same thing. And I found that so that's basically very true. It happens all the time. People use those terms interchangeably. One of the first things that I do in the book as well is to distinguish between those. And also in any workshops I've ever done, I often distinguish between those and explain they're completely different things. Mm-hmm. Git is a version control system. You download it onto your computer. And then GitHub is this, it's a company. It's a hosting where you can host your project that use Git.
A very large company now.
A very large company. And there's other ones, GitLab, Bitbucket, and there's others as well. But those are just the three biggest ones. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes the way that I give like a little bit of a metaphor, which is just think about Microsoft Word. It's something that it's downloaded on your computer.
Yeah.
And then Google Drive, let's say. So GitHub is like Google Drive. It's a way to store things in the cloud. It's not, but yeah, it's just for the metaphor. There's a lot of differences. But so that's GitHub versus Git. Pull requests are a feature of GitHub and on GitLab, they're called merge requests, but they're basically the same thing. And actually, in my book, I do say that I won't teach too many things about hosting services, but I did decide to teach pull requests. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going to, and then I added an extra chapter and covered that topic. And I stated very, very clearly and explicitly that this isn't a feature of Git. It's a feature of a hosting service, but it is so important in working with Git that I will cover it in the book because, it's essential, almost essential.
Do you cover in any of the visual tools? I'm a personal fan of Fork, but there's a Tower on Mac, Kraken. Do you cover any of those or do you remain totally agnostic and just on the command line?
I remain totally agnostic, just on the command line. I just thought to myself, first of all, you can't fit everything. So I thought to myself, I'll just teach the command line and help them learn a mental model of how it works. But I really don't mind if someone then wants to go and use a GUI tool. There's one other thing that I should mention about this. I actually have not one screenshot in my book. So if I were to have covered any of those.
Screenshots in Git are a pain. So.
I mean, I just knew that if I ever included a screenshot in my book, the minute that it's published, it's already out of date. So I did not want to do that.
No, it's fair enough. It's fair enough.
So yeah, it would have been really hard to cover a GUI tool without including any screenshots anyways.
No, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there anything that you left out that you now realize you shouldn't have? And for the second edition, you will hopefully include.
Yeah, I think forking is basically the one thing that I think I should have covered.
Interesting. It's actually interesting that you could cover the flexibility. Obviously, anyone who forks tends to have a particular goal in mind. It's more of it's also a conceptual concept and a decision more than a technical concept in some respects.
Yeah. But
it's also a fair fundamental that brings, I actually come from long enough ago that I had to use SVN, which predates Git, and it didn't have that concept. And it's one of those fundamental things that sets Git apart. Not wanting to make it sound like a criticism, but why not?
Why not? In all honesty, Chris, just because I personally haven't used it that much.
A lot of companies make you fork. So that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, in my case, I haven't used it much, so it just wasn't in my mental landscape as a concept that I should teach. Okay. But I completely agreed with that Amazon review, and I definitely think that in the future it needs to be something that will be covered.
Yep. No, fine. And there's, don't worry, I often get that with some of my videos as well. It's like, how could you forget about this? It's like, often I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
and B, because there's only so much time in the world. But and also C, which I'd like to come to in the next set of quick questions. Editors sometimes tell you to do things, especially with books. On that, so let's talk about the process. It looks like you've done a lot of learning, but I think as far as I can tell, this is your first book. Yeah?
Yeah, this is my first book. And before this, the only other...
Video courses or...
Yeah, was an online course, which at the moment is on Udemy. Who knows where it will be in the future.
How was your experience with that? How long did it take? You put on LinkedIn 8 months. Was that actually... How long? Or was that just...
No. Is that what I put on LinkedIn? I don't even know.
But so, I don't worry. I'm working on books as well. And I know people are like, what have you been doing? And I've been working on a book. Okay. And people are like, huh? It's
let
quite
me
time
give,
consuming.
Let me give a bit of insight on the book writing journey. So basically, I contacted various publishers and ended up deciding that I wanted to write it with O'Reilly.
It's nice you had the choice to work with someone like O'Reilly, because it's a publisher that a lot of people aim for and don't get the chance to work for.
Yeah, so. It's very true. I am really lucky. So I'd contacted them in spring of 2021, and I told them that I was interested in writing this book. I think it was March 2021. Okay. And they were immediately interested.
Was it your idea, or you saw that they were looking for... Okay.
No, it was my idea. I already had this concept of using the colors and the storytelling and the visuals to teach. And I knew that I actually knew I wanted to write this book when I was making the online course back in 2019, 2020. But I knew that the barrier to entry to write a book, I think in my thinking, it was higher than to make the online course. So I thought I'll do the online course first. And then when the opportunity comes, I'll write the book. So finally, I decided, okay, I'm going to write this book. I contacted O'Reilly. They were immediately interested, which I'm really lucky about. But I think that they were convinced because I know they were convinced because I later interviewed them and asked them, why did you guys sign me? Because I didn't have that much experience in the tech space, and they usually don't take first-time authors. So they said that it was because I could prove that I was really good at teaching through the reviews from the online course and also the workshops. But anyway, so I got in touch with them. They were immediately interested. And then I decided I wasn't going to sign the contract with them yet because I really wanted to write the entire first draft of the book on my own.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. So maybe I can just backtrack and just tell you a little bit more about what happens in the book to explain why I want to write the first draft on my own. Basically, in the book, you're working on this repository. It's a hands-on learning experience, and it's called the Rainbow Repository. And you're listing the colors of the rainbow. So red is the first color of the rainbow. Orange is the second color of the rainbow. And every time you add a color of the rainbow, you make a commit. In other words, you save a version of your project. And the commit in the diagrams that I have in the book has the color that you just added to the rainbow. So you and I represent commits as circles. So you have a little red circle and then a little orange circle. So basically, I'm using the rainbow and the colors of the rainbow to teach various features of Git. And in my mind, this was a really out-of-the-box idea. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write the very first draft of the book in order to be able to present my vision of it without anyone trying to push back or being a little hesitant about it. Because, you know, me pitching to someone, I'm going to use the colors of the rainbow to teach Git. They might have been like, yeah, we don't know if that's going to be right for our audience. I could also be wrong. They may have been completely open to it. But I'm one of those people that, like, I consider myself a creative, and I wanted to get into my little creative bubble and make this. So I started writing the book in August of 2021, and I wrote the entire first draft on my own in about 4 to 5 months. And then in the spring of 2022, I got back in touch with O'Reilly a year later. And that's when we started our collaboration. So I thought this book was going to take me 1 year. It took me almost 2 years to write it. But I should also mention that I used a really UX design approach or design approach to writing it, because I did 3 rounds of user testing with 30 plus user testers. And I think that's what took the longest, the user testing and then the incorporating the feedback from the user testing. So, yeah. That was my book writing journey. And to be honest, yeah, it was great working with O'Reilly. An editor can always give you feedback that you'll not have thought of.
Did you do all the user testing before you took it to O'Reilly?
No. I did one round of user testing, I think, before. And I think I'd think two rounds while I'd already started with them. But the user testing was all on my end. So that was my initiative. I don't think they've ever seen that before.
Did you have any pushback from that? Because I know publishers and editors will have opinions on things, but I would have thought that you were also quite opinionated and had a lot of evidence to show maybe that your opinion was valid. And did you have to?
So I didn't have any pushback in terms of actually doing the user testing, and I didn't have any pushback in terms of, oh no, don't send the book to anyone. That was absolutely fine.
Just in terms of things you had implemented is not really the right word.
Yeah,
things
yeah.
In the book that you knew to be the right way because you had this evidence, and they would say, oh, and but you could justify your.
I'm sure there were things, but I can't actually think of exactly which things. But the only thing I would say with pushback was, obviously, like I told you, I thought this book was going to take a lot less time than it did. So I sometimes would tell my editor, it'll be ready by this date, and then that date would come around and I would be like, the user testing is taking longer than expected. I need to incorporate the feedback. After this round of user testing, I realized there's a lot more things I need to work on, and because I really 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 wanted this learning resource to be 150% my best work, I was not willing to hand in the book until I really, really thought it was ready. So the only pushback I got was, wait, so you're going to delay again? But to be honest, we'd set like very, very aggressive timelines. So I actually, in the contract, I handed in my book like months, maybe half a year before the contract.
Oh, okay. So you weren't actually late.
So no, it was only late for the internal deadlines that we had set with my editor, but for the actual contract, it was not.
Sounds pretty good. And has so far, based on I think like a month of release, something like that,
couple months
has all the extra work you put in, I mean, you feel like it was worth it?
Yes, 100%. First of all, I just love it when people add an Amazon review or message me on LinkedIn or comment on LinkedIn or post or anything. When I hear that I've helped someone with the thing that I've created, it just makes me very happy, basically. So it's definitely been worth it. And obviously, publishing a book, it opens up a lot of doors, a lot of opportunities for other things. So I'm really glad that I committed to this project and I've realized it.
Okay, cool. And on the subject of that, because we're running a little bit out of time, you talk about opportunities. You are in Barcelona, but it looks like you're moving to Amsterdam or the Netherlands. I don't know. People sometimes think of it as the same. Amsterdam is incredibly hard to move to, so it may just be the Netherlands.
Yeah, it actually is the Netherlands. I'm moving to The Hague. Yeah,
The Hague is very nice.
Yeah, it is really nice. I grew up in a suburb of The Hague, 18 years. I grew up there. So I've been away for 10 years now, spent 5 years in the UK and 5 years in Spain. And it just felt like the time to go back to the home base.
Okay, cool. And has the book opened doors? People often, especially in the tech space, we often do books not for the money, because actually you don't make very much. It's often for the opportunity and the credibility without going into any detail. Has it opened any doors yet?
I definitely think it has. Speaking opportunities and it's never, it has. It just in various different ways.
Yeah.
Connections. I get to be on podcasts, which is really fun. I really love going on podcasts and chatting about teaching and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right then. I think you're going to have a few bits of information to give out. So listen carefully, everybody. Firstly, how can people find out more about you? And secondly, if people want to have a good direct link to the book itself, where can they find it?
Okay, so first of all, to find me, I'd say either you can find out more about me on my website, and I'll give that in a second, and also on LinkedIn. I'm luckily the only Anna Skulikari in this world, so just Googling me, anything, it's easy to find me. So I'm going to, so my website is www.annaskulikari.com, and I'm going to spell out my name because, A-N-N-A-S-K-O-U-L-I-K-A-R-I. Anna Scully Kari. Mm-hmm. And on LinkedIn, again, Anna Scully Kari. So those mm-hmm. are the best ways to find me. And then from there, you can find any other links, YouTube, Twitter, and all that stuff. But I'm not really active on anything else other than LinkedIn at the moment.
It seems to be coming the new trend.
Yeah, maybe it will change. Who knows? But I'm not really too much on social media. I'm just doing one for now.
Yeah.
And then I have a link that gives someone free access okay. to the O'Reilly Learning Platform for 30 days. Okay. And you can definitely read my book on that platform within 30 days. So basically mm-hmm. you can read the book for free for 30 days. And we'll include the link probably in the description, but the code that you can use when you go on the O'Reilly platform and you want to sign up is LearnGit23.
Okay, so that's easy enough.
It's easy enough. LearnGit23. But we'll also leave the link that already has the code in it, which is easier maybe for some people. And that gives you 30-day free access. You can read the book and you can read anything else or learn from videos and all the other mm-hmm. resources they have on there. So yeah, and otherwise, obviously, you can find the book on Amazon or all the other book places you buy books. But also, if people do get the book, please leave me a review. I love reviews. And I know I've sold a lot more books than I have gotten reviews. So leave a review. I guess I only want the positive ones, but maybe the constructive
ones
are important.
It depends what the negative review is. If you get negative reviews, you're like, this is crap yeah. or whatever. But if it's like constructive, then that's not yeah. always bad. And sometimes you can yeah. actually engage with those people. I've had many a constructive conversation on YouTube from responding to a bad review and then mm-hmm. changing someone's opinion because they're like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about it.
I've been really lucky, though. Up until now, all the reviews have been stellar. So I guess I'm hoping for that to continue.
Cool. Okay. And apart from moving back home, my yes. final question is usually what's next for the next 6 months, 12 years? What have you got planned or what do you hope to have planned? What would you like to do?
I don't know if I should reveal what I'm planning at the moment okay. because it's so new at the moment, but I think I will be continuing in the Git education space, but I want to look into new mediums and okay. Also teaching some other things. For example, in this book, I did not teach anyone how to work with Git in the real world. Yeah. Listing the colors yeah. of the rainbow is not yeah. a realistic yeah. example yeah. of a project. So maybe I want to get into creating some material that will teach people more about, okay, give me some stories about how it's actually used mm-hmm, in the workplace. Mm-hmm. But the medium is still something I'm playing around with. So I shouldn't say anything because then I might look back and say, oh, why did I say that? That did not happen.
Keep an eye on your website.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Chris.
And I'm back. That was my interview with Anna talking about her book, Learn Git. As you heard towards the end there, head on over to O'Reilly.com, put in LearnGit23, and you can get 30-day access to the platform there. I will see if she wants to supply any special links just for you as well. And if so, I'll put those in the description wherever you happen to consume your podcast. You can find that there. Not too much from me. Still getting warmed up from the beginning of the year. We also had a little bit of a personal crisis last week. We unfortunately had to put our very old cat to rest. I was struggling with a benign tumor that was on its neck, giving it breathing problems, eating problems, things like that. It was 17. The vet basically said it was inoperable, so it was time to say goodbye. The only thing I really wrote was about that. It's currently on my Medium, a little bit different from my usual stuff, but that's my way of processing grief. I'm working on a few videos at the moment. I'm working on a roundup of transcription tools, actually. And I'm also working on a greening website, making websites more sustainable, using my own website as a case study as well. Also editing. Actually, I haven't really told you about this. I have a new podcast out called Whiskey and Waffle. Episode 1 is already out. I'm currently editing episode 2. It's quite different from this show. I'm not going to say much more right now because we're just doing soft launching of it. But if you look that up, Whiskey and Waffle, you will find it. Yeah. I don't know if listeners of this show will like it. It's a bit different, but there we go. There it is. And I'm also putting together a series of shorts that were readings from my forthcoming flash fiction collection, and gearing towards the release of my first novel. So lots of underpinning work going on at the moment. I think that's it. If you are at FOSDEM in Brussels in the first weekend in February, I'll be there co-running the Tool the Docs dev room again. So come over and say hi. If you don't hear from me before then, which you probably will next week and the week after. I think February is further away than I thought. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, please rate, review, or share wherever you are listening. Very appreciated. Head on over to chrischinchilla.com for more and also how to support me. And until next time, thank you very much and take care, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at chrischinchilla.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.